how many of you are acquainted with Lewis's Mere Christianity. I brought along all the copies that the bookstore has, and I want to do some reading from the book this afternoon. In fact, each of the days, a reading, or some reading at least, from the book that we talk about. The bookstore will be closed till tomorrow morning again. So if you want to buy one, I suppose I could sell them to you. I didn't bring any change along or anything like that, but we'll just work at it a little bit. I have had a sort of affection for Lewis as long as I've been studying theology. I was a seminary student back in 1950, I think, almost 30 years ago now, when I first came across Lewis's earliest writings. That was when Mere Christianity wasn't even Mere Christianity yet. It was still three other books. It was The Case for Christianity, which is a one volume book, and then Christian Behavior and Beyond Personality. And I still have in my library, I think, the little hardcover editions of these books that were eventually combined into this paperback. Maybe it would be best to say some things about Lewis, first of all, before we do some reading out of Mere Christianity. You can buy Lewis's own autobiography. It's called Surprised by Joy. He describes there in, I think, a most objective way his own life, his own development, the people who were influential in his life, and brings it well up into his conversion to Christianity, which occurred sometime in 1929. But an excellent little biographical book, it's really not so little, is this picture history called C.S. Lewis's Images of His World. It's been done by Douglas Gilbert and Clyde Kilby. Kilby teaches at Wheaton College. It's just outside of Chicago. The book is a stunning collection of photographs of people who were friends of Lewis, places that he knew, many of them in color. Wish I could show you some of them. This is Oxford's High Street. This is an example of the kind of thing in the book. The chapel, the rooms at Magdalen College and the view from those rooms here, pictures of Lewis's home. Here is a portrait of the senior fellows, or the fellows in the senior common room at Magdalen College at Oxford, with Lewis sitting back in his chair over in the corner, and other people, other friends of his, Colin Hardy, James Griffith, J.W. Bennett, and so on, sitting there. It's a marvelous collection of Lewis, friends of his, people with whom he was associated. Here is Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, a friend of Lewis's, who wrote the Hobbit stories, I'm trying to find scenes from Lewis's home, his housekeeper. The whole thing is just a delightful book. One of the best features of it is the chronology of Lewis's own life that gives some of the key biographical information in just little paragraphs. Lewis, as you know, was born in 1898 in Northern Ireland. His mother died when he was young. He was sent away to boarding schools, as was the custom for most English boys. He hated his boarding schools. He was a very imaginative child, and and really had some difficult years at the boarding schools. From 1914 to 1916, Lewis spent some very formative years with a... Oh, you weren't raising your hand. Oh, you were waving at somebody. Okay. All right. Lewis spent some very formative years with... 2 years, actually, living with a man called W.T. Kirkpatrick, a person whom Lewis called the Great Knock. Kirkpatrick was a man of compelling logical force who never wanted words wasted. Lewis's earliest memory of him was that as they were walking from the railroad station to Kirkpatrick's home the day Lewis arrived, Lewis just happened to observe that it was interesting countryside, and Kirkpatrick said, "What do you mean by that?" Lewis said, "I didn't mean anything. I was just making conversation." He said, "Well, we don't make that kind of conversation. Either it was or it wasn't interesting, and if it was, on what grounds, and so on." I just proceeded to take a simple remark and press him. Lewis studied Greek, Latin, French, German, and Italian, as well as logic with Kirkpatrick, but the logic was almost thrown in as a sort of by the way. Kirkpatrick himself was an atheist, and but a rigorously thinking person. And the curious characteristic of Lewis, the thing that has attracted him to me from the beginning, I think, is that he is one of the few people who didn't become a Christian because of emotional grounds or personal needs, but because he argued himself out of every other position. That is to say, he didn't even argue himself into being a Christian. It was just nothing else seemed to be logically viable. So his conversion later on in life to Christianity made him, as he himself says in his autobiography, the most reluctant convert in all of England. Well, at any rate, Lewis then went to Oxford, but the First World War was going on, of course, and Lewis actually failed one of his entrance examinations to Oxford, and probably would not have been admitted had it not been for the curious circumstances of the First World War. Before he could actually get well underway in his studies, he was in the army and spent some time in the trenches in France, where he was wounded and was sent home because of being gassed. He came home somewhat before the end of the war, May 22nd, 1918. He was returned to England. And after the war, of course, there were some different admission standards, and he was in Oxford, where he studied philosophy, classics, English literature, and began his teaching career as a philosopher, not as a professor of English, which was his position throughout most of his life. As a result of the war, he took on a responsibility that he continued to carry out for the rest of her life, at least. He became a friend of a young man named Paddy Moore, who was killed in the war, and Lewis then took on the responsibility of caring for Paddy Moore's mother and sister, providing a home for them. Mrs. Moore was apparently a very disagreeable woman, and not easy to live with, but Lewis insisted on carrying out this obligation to his friend to become literally a son to this woman. It was one of the remarkable things, I think, about Lewis, and one he very rarely alluded to. He just simply regarded it as a duty, as a responsibility, as a promise, and he was not going to go back on it. At Oxford, and especially in his teaching years, he began to meet a number of people whose intellectual qualities could not be doubted. They were very intellectually gifted people, but people who were also Christians. And Lewis was not. He had had the conventional religious upbringing of a young person in England, but totally, he said, totally disbelieved in every doctrine of Christianity and took his first communion in total disbelief. And then for years thereafter, especially as the result of his studies and his war years and his experiences with Kirkpatrick, he simply had nothing to do with Christianity. To the end of his life, there were many things that he just simply couldn't stand. He never did learn to like organ music, and didn't really like daily chapel. But once he became a Christian, decided he ought to go. So although he didn't like it, he went. He was that kind of a person. Once he discovered what he felt was his duty, even if he didn't like it, he did it. He knew that there were many things about life itself and about Christianity and about being a human being that were not very pleasant, but they were necessary, and so they were to be done, and he just simply did them. It was in 1920, well, he began to read. He still remembers, he says, the influence of George MacDonald upon him, and it began when he read George MacDonald's little book, Fantasties. And in 1929, he writes this about his conversion. He found himself one day simply confessing in his rooms at Magdalen College that God was God. And sometime later, he and his brother set out by motorcycle for a visit to Whipsnade Zoo, about 30 miles east of Oxford. He doesn't know what happened to him exactly, but he knows that when he set out, he did not believe in Jesus, and when he came back from that trip, he did. It was a sort of an afternoon affair. It was nothing dramatic, but as he himself says, he could no longer doubt the validity of Christianity. That is, it was not so much a positive attraction as that negatively nothing else seemed to make sense. I don't want to, we haven't got time, I suppose, today to go into the whole of Lewis's life. He, once he became a Christian, he turned all of the vigor of his own mind toward writing about Christianity, although he was never like an ex-smoker who now had to convert everybody to non-smoking or something like that. But it's simply that he wasn't able to write about Christianity with all the vigor of his mind. He was never a professional theologian. And so all of his books on Christianity, and there are many, are really the books of an amateur, of a layman. His profession was to be a teacher of Renaissance English literature, which he, a profession which he fulfilled with great vigor. His students still recall that he lectured with enormous vitality, that he never liked to waste a moment, that if he was just so much as a couple of minutes late to his lectures, he would start lecturing and bellow at the top of his voice as he was still coming up the stairway to his lecture hall, and march into the room lecturing and all the way down to the podium, and never break his sentence while he was getting his notes out and everything else. A man who had very close friends, among them Charles Williams, Dorothy Sayers, J.R.R. Tolkien. They formed a little group called the Inklings that met for discussion. He frequently describes his ideal way to spend a day is to get up, have a breakfast about 9, write vigorously at his desk until 1 or so, break for lunch, go for a walk in the afternoon, come back and have tea at 4, work again until 7, and then spend the evening smoking pipe, drinking port, sitting around a fire, and having a serious conversation with tough minds and good friends. That's the way he would like to spend his days. He married late in life. He married a woman who had herself been converted to Christianity as a result of reading Lewis's writings. Her name was Joy Gresham Davis. She was already ill with cancer when they were married. She experienced a remission. They went on a trip to Greece, and she died in 1960, 3 years before Lewis' own death. They were married, I think, just 3 years. He wrote, he kept a kind of diary of observations of his own grieving that is a classic now in the literature of grief. It's called A Grief Observed, and I was going to do that as the last of the books this week on Friday, but we don't have enough copies in the bookstore. So I substituted another favorite of mine, a book of his sermons called The Weight of Glory. He preached with reasonable regularity in churches in Oxford and other places in England, where you don't have to be a professional clergy person to be a good preacher, and was a faithful member of his Anglican parish church, even though he didn't like liturgy and ritual all that much either. He died in 1963 on the same day that John Kennedy was assassinated, and was buried simply in a place in the churchyard of his parish. There is a little grave marker, Headington Quarry Parish Church. That's the grave marker of Lewis's grave. His wife's gravestone is one that Lewis wrote himself. If I can find it in here quickly, I'll read it, because it's a stunning statement in poetry. I will find it. It's just, I should have looked some of these things up, I guess, in advance. I thought I could find them fairly quickly. One of the great things about Lewis is his ability to move with relative ease from fiction to his own professional specialty, to the kind of literature that characterizes these works that we're going to read. Ah, here it is. This is a picture of Lewis with his wife, and this is the epitaph that he wrote for her. I'll have to see if I can read it off here. Here the whole world, stars, water, air, and field and forest, as they were reflected in a single mind, like cast-off clothes, was left behind. In ashes, yet with hope that she, reborn from holy poverty in Lenten lands, hereafter may resume them on her Easter day. Mm-hmm. Just a lovely epitaph for his wife. Well, let me just say a couple of things about Lewis's major body of Christian writings. They fall into a number of categories. One are his essays and sermons. We're going to look at a collection of those. This is A Grief Observed. I think it's also available in paperback. His essays and sermons, like Critical Reflection, Christian Reflections, or God in the Dock, or The Weight of Glory that we're going to look at. Then secondly, fiction, Christian fiction. He wrote a series of 7 delightful stories for children called the Narnia Tales, after which our own Narnia is named here. Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. We bought them, read them to our children. I started reading some of these to youngsters when I myself taught school. They were just marvelous books to read to children. And just a great deal of fun. But in addition to that, he wrote adult fiction, 3 science fiction novels, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength, and some things like Till We Have Faces and The Great Divorce, a little bit of fantasy that we're going to read one of the days this week, and then, of course, his imaginary letters written by a senior devil to a junior tempter called the Screwtape Letters. I still have hardcover editions of a lot of these things. So essays and sermons, first class, fiction, the second category, and the third category are these kinds of books like Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain, which we'll do the first couple of days. I've used these as textbooks. I've taught courses on Lewis at the seminary and still enjoy reading them. Every time I pick them up, it's almost as fresh as the first time I read them. The Case for Christianity, or the book Mere Christianity, began as a series of broadcast talks in England in the Second World War. The BBC, British Broadcasting System, asked Lewis to do just a series of short 15-minute talks on religious subjects in the heart of World War II, for England, that is. They were done in 1940. And they still have the quality of these broadcast talks. I don't know if our library here at Holden has them, but we, at the seminary in Columbus, we have four tape recordings, four cassettes that were made by Lewis reading the Four Loves, just reading them out loud. You can hear his voice, a resonant voice, a marvelously richly textured voice. But Lewis gave these broadcast talks. They were enormously popular, and hundreds of thousands of people heard them, wrote for them, and so they were published in thin little volumes. The first one was called The Case for Christianity. The second one was called Christian Behavior, where he takes up some of the aspects of Christian ethics. And the third one was called Beyond Personality, First Steps in a Christian Doctrine of the Trinity. And the three of them were then combined by Macmillan, his American publisher, in a little book that's since been called Mere Christianity. He tried, the title Mere Christianity comes from his own preface. He writes in the preface that there are a lot of things about which he does not want to talk, but he wanted to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times. And he sent his manuscript to both Protestant and Catholic theologians to make sure that he was saying things which were common to all Christians. And he writes, the silence on certain issues does not mean that I myself am sitting on the fence. Sometimes I am. There are questions at issue between Christians to which I do not think I have the answer. There are some to which I may never know the answer. If I asked them even in a better world, I might, for all I know, be answered as a far greater questioner was answered, "What is that to thee? Follow thou me." But there are other questions as to which I am definitely on one side of the fence and yet say nothing, for I was not writing to expound something I could call my religion, but to expound mere Christianity, which is what it is, and was what it was long before I was born, and whether I like it or not. I remember another English theologian by the name of J.V. Langmead Casserly, who wrote a book about Christianity called No Faith of My Own, in which he said that before he was a Christian, he had his own faith, but once he became a Christian, he didn't have his own anymore. He entered into a faith that was there before him and would be there after him. Lewis felt very much the same way. And in an interesting passage out of Christian Behavior, he writes this, which is illustrative of his attitude. He says, this is a chapter called Forgiveness. Everyone, he says that forgiveness is a lovely idea until they have something to forgive, as we had during the war. And then to mention the subject at all is to be greeted with howls of anger. It is not that people think this too high and difficult a virtue. It is that they think it hateful and contemptible. That sort of talk makes them sick, they say. And half of you already want to ask me, I wonder how you'd feel about forgiving the Gestapo if you were a Pole or a Jew. So do I, Lewis writes. I wonder very much. Just as when Christianity tells me I must not deny my religion even to save myself from death by torture, I wonder very much what I should do when it came to the point. I'm not trying to tell you in this book what I could do. I can do precious little. I'm telling you what Christianity is. I didn't invent it. So marvelous, marvelous things. Okay, what Lewis is doing, let's take each of these parts of the book then by itself. What Lewis is doing in the first part of this book, called The Case for Christianity, is something that I would like to call grounding. Lewis asks not what Jesus means to him or how he feels about Christianity. In fact, he's written a little book called The Abolition of Man, in which, in fact, it's in the bookstore. I didn't bring a copy over, but it's one of the books we could have read this week. But in The Abolition of Man, the whole point that he's making there is that when we substitute feeling for thinking, then we have really begun to abolish unique human existence. And he's writing specifically against that form of education which asks you mostly, how do you feel about this or that, instead of, is it true? and he cites examples from textbooks trying to teach people how to experience their world, that the primary question, which the authors suggest over and over again is important, is how we feel about certain things. Lewis was adamant all his life that how we feel about things really matters nothing at all, or very little, as to what we should do about them. If they are true, whether we like them or not, we ought to accept them. If they are true, we ought to accept them simply because they're true, not because we feel good or they make us feel good. And similarly about duty. If something is our duty, it ought to be done, even if we do not feel like it. And he didn't just say this, as I tried to indicate it. He lived it. He didn't particularly like Mrs. Moore, but he provided a home with her and functioned as if he were her son all the years of her life. It was some, I guess, 30 years that he cared for her after World War I. And she was not a particularly likable person. This comes up again in the Screwtape Letters. We'll talk about this, I think, on Wednesday. So his main concern was to ask not how we feel about religion or God or anything else, but whether or not there are grounds for making the kinds of assertions that we make. Lewis says, first of all, that there are in fact valid experiential and intellectual grounds, reasons, for believing God. They are not very comfortable grounds, however, and I'm going to describe that in a moment. And then secondly, he stops and starts over again. The grounds for whatever Christians say about Christianity, the grounds for that, the reasons for that, lie in the event of Jesus. So he has, in a sense, two sets of groundings, two sets of reasons, one for thinking theologically at all, and then another for thinking Christianly. And he sort of stops and starts over. It isn't, again, you see, that you can argue yourself from a general belief about God into Christianity. One never moves that way, because the encounter with God, as Lewis tries to point out, is a terrifying encounter. It is an encounter with that which calls us into question. It is real, it is valid, it is true, but it is terrifying. And part of the reason, he thinks, why we frequently abandon logic when it comes to asking the question about God is because we don't want to face the kinds of things that we encounter when we pursue that question logically. What we encounter is so frightening that we would much rather surround ourselves with what sometimes gets called warm fuzzies today, that is, things that make us feel good, except that they may well turn out to be illusions. Well, how does Lewis ground the encounter with God? He does it in Book One in Mere Christianity, called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. What does he mean by that? I'm going to try to describe what he says very simply. He says that all of us operate with some sense or notion of right and wrong. We may disagree profoundly as to the content of what is right and what is wrong, but we all operate with the notion of right and wrong. I'm going to use an example that isn't in Lewis. Hugh Hefner, who publishes Playboy magazine and writes the Playboy philosophy, doesn't go around saying, I know that promiscuous sex is wrong, but let us do it anyway. His philosophy is an attempt to say, you people who don't practice promiscuity, you are the ones who are really fouling up humanity. You are wrong, you are prudes, you are Victorian, you are monogamous, you are all kinds of bad and wrong things. What is really right is for consenting adults to just treat each other as playmates of one kind or another, playboys and playgirls. That's right. Okay, now what Hefner is arguing here may differ widely from the people who follow a more conventional form of sexual morality, but Hefner is still arguing, I'm right and you're wrong, you see. Now, what Hefner is arguing here may differ widely from the people who follow a more conventional form of sexual morality, but Hefner is still arguing, I'm right and you're wrong, you see. Even if the content differs, the form of the argument is the same. My practice is justified. It's right. It's the only way to go. Why don't you all live that way, you see? Or people who say there are no absolute moral rules are in fact proposing an absolute moral rule, namely that there are no absolutes, you see? There, in short, there is hardly any way to get out of it. The man who says there is no truth is asserting that as a truth, do you see? So that in one way or another, it's virtually impossible for us to function without something making some kind of a claim on us. Albert Camus tried to describe in one of his really devastating novels, The Stranger, tried to describe a person who had no moral or intellectual convictions at all. And he's really writing in the end about a zombie, not about a human being at all. I don't know if you've ever read The Stranger, any of you, but this is a terrifying book to read. It's Camus' attempt to try to describe somebody who just lives with total indifference to everything, to other people, to his mother, to himself, to another human being. He's eventually executed because he shoots a person on a beach without any involvement, with none. And what he has written about is a zombie, literally. You know, it's just frightening to read. And I think the book is well named. It is The Stranger. If we live at all, if we are human at all, we will have some convictions, and in fact, those convictions will involve us inevitably in the thing about right and wrong. Now, but the point is that we can assert them, we can assert a standard of right and wrong only if it lies outside of ourselves. Only, Lewis says, if it applies beyond ourselves and applies even to us, if it comes from outside of ourselves. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Otherwise, we're only saying, you're making me uncomfortable. But I can't be saying you're doing something that both of us would agree ought not to be done. I can only appeal to that sense of oughtness if I am appealing to something outside of either one of us. If Joyce suddenly gets up from this chair and pushes me over into your chair so that maybe all of us are confused and hurt, I say, Joyce, you ought not to do that. She might just say, why not? I felt like doing it. If we were in her way, if it was just a matter of convenience, then we can't appeal to her at all. So to make an appeal at all, to be able to say, you ought not to do that, and I ought not to do that, means there must be a standard outside of ourselves. And that's why he says that something, it may yet be impersonal. He says we haven't gotten to anything like a personal God, but something lies behind the sense of oughtness to which we appeal when we invoke questions of right or wrong, of fairness or unfairness, of the behavior of people toward each other. Something lies behind it. Let's say a standard of some sort. Maybe there's a passage there that we could read. From his observations about the moral law, he says, we discover that kind of power in the universe which reveals itself only in the sense that in the place where we could expect it to show itself, and that would be inside us as an influence or as a command trying to get us to behave in a certain way. And that is what we do find, he said. In the only case where you can expect to get an answer about this someone or something, the answer turns out to be yes. In other cases where you do not get an answer, you see why you do not. So he says we do have a someone or a something that is directing the universe. And that lies behind the moral law. But it is not designed, he says, to make us comfortable. And this is what he writes. He says, I ended my last chapter with the idea that in the moral law, somebody or something from beyond the material universe was actually getting at us, and I expect when I reached that point, some of you felt a certain annoyance. You may even thought that I had played a trick on you, that I had been carefully wrapping up to look like philosophy what turns out to be just one more religious jaw. You may have felt you were ready to listen to me as long as you thought I had anything new to say, but if it turns out to be only religion, well, the world has tried that, and you can't put the clock back. If anyone is feeling that way, I should like to say three things to him in turn. First of all, as to putting the clock back, would you think I was joking if I said you can put a clock back, and that if a clock is wrong, it is often only the only very sensible thing to do? But I would rather get away from that whole idea of clocks. We all want progress, but progress means getting nearer the place where you want to be. And if you have taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer at all. If you are on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive. We have all seen this when doing arithmetic. When I started a sum the wrong way, the sooner I admit it and going back to starting over again, the faster I shall get on. There is nothing progressive about being pig-headed and refusing to admit a mistake. And I think if you look at the present state of the world, it is pretty plain that humanity has been making some big mistakes. We are on the wrong road. And if that is so, we must going back. We must go back, for going back is the quickest way to get on. Secondly, this has not turned into a religious jaw. We have not even yet got as far as the God of any actual religion. Still, yes, the God of that religion called Christianity. We have only gotten as far as a somebody or a something behind the moral law. We are not taking anything from the Bible or the churches. We are simply trying to see what we can find out about this on our own. And I want to make it quite clear that what we find out on our own is something that gives us a shock. We have two bits of evidence about the somebody. One is the universe he has made. If we use that as our only clue, I think we should have to conclude that he was an artist, but also quite merciless, and no friend to man, for the universe is a very dangerous and terrifying place. And the other bit of evidence is that the moral law which he has put into our minds is the moral law which he has put into our minds. And this is a better bit of evidence than the other, because it is inside information. But the point is that this God, or whatever it is anything but indulgent. It does not give us any grounds for thinking that God is good in the sense of being indulgent, or soft, or sympathetic. There is nothing indulgent about the moral law. It is as hard as nails. It tells you to do the straight thing, and it does not seem to care how painful, or dangerous, or difficult it is to do. If God is like the moral law, then he is not soft. And it is no use at this stage saying that what you mean by a good God is a God who can forgive. You're going too quickly. Only a person can forgive, and we have not yet got as far as a personal God. We have only gotten to a power behind the moral law. It may be more like a mind than anything else, but it is still very unlike a person. And if it is pure impersonal mind, there may be no sense at all in asking it to make allowances for you or to let you off, just as there is no sense in asking the multiplication table to let you off when you do your sums wrong. You are bound to get a wrong answer. And it is no use either saying that if there is a God of that sort, then you don't like him and are not going to bother about him. For the trouble is that one part of you is already on his side and really agrees with his disapproval of human greed and trickery and exploitation. You may want to make an exception in your own case, or to have you let off this one time, but you know that at bottom, unless the power behind the world really and unalterably detests that sort of behavior, then he cannot be good. And on the other hand, we know that if there does exist an absolute goodness, it must hate most of what we do. That's the terrible fix we are in. If the universe is not governed by an absolute goodness, then all our efforts are in the long run hopeless. But if it is, then we are making ourselves enemies to that goodness every day, and are not in the least likely to do any better tomorrow. So our case is hopeless again. We cannot do without it, and we cannot do with it. I think I've skipped a point in the argument here. Lewis is saying that, in fact, human relationships cannot really do without this kind of moral absolute. You know, our relationships founder. They just simply then become matters of convenience. I've often thought about this as maybe the way we are going to react to the energy crisis. We are finally simply going to say, all right, if it wrecks the dollar that we're pouring these billions of dollars into the Arab coffers, if it's going to do it to our currency, why, we'll just land the Marines in Saudi Arabia and take over the country, and our convenience and our economy and our style of life will dictate what we're going to do, no matter what the rights of those people or that nation may be. We'll take that course of action rather than the harder course of maybe cutting back on our fuel and energy needs or finding alternative forms of energy. It's much the same thing that we do in relation to Native Americans in this country. You see, we said we don't care what's right or wrong. We want this land, and we're bigger than you, and we're just going to take it. But that way of proceeding, in which we are not going to be judged by anything outside of ourselves, will turn on us, you see, because we usually want to cry foul when we are the injured party. But if we're going to do that, then we have to also be able to have foul cried against us when we do the injuring. So Lewis's point is, we can't really live without the moral law. We all know deep in our hearts that might doesn't make right, and we'll appeal to that when we are the injured. And yet if we have to live with the moral law, then we discover that we are offenders against it. And now my third point. When I choose to get to my real subject in this roundabout way, I'm not trying to play any kind of a trick on you. I had a different reason. My reason was that Christianity itself does not make sense until you have faced the sort of facts I have been describing. Christianity tells people to repent, and it promises them forgiveness. It has nothing to say to people who do not know they need to repent and who do not sense they need forgiveness. After you have realized that there is a law and a power behind it, after all this, and not a moment sooner, then Christianity begins to make sense to you. When you know you're sick, you listen to a doctor. When you have realized that our position is nearly desperate, you will begin to understand what Christians are talking about. They offer an explanation of how we got into our fix and also a way of talking about God as a person. But I'm trying to ask people to face facts, to understand the questions to which Christianity claims to have answers. They are terrifying facts. I wish it was possible to say something more agreeable, but I must say what I think is true. I quite agree that the Christian religion is in the long run a thing of unspeakable comfort, but it does not begin in comfort. It begins in the dismay I have been describing. And it is no use at all trying to go on to the comfort without first going through the dismay. In religion, as in everything else, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end, but if you look only for comfort, you will get neither comfort nor truth, just soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. Well, so Lewis is saying the grounds for language about God are going to turn out to be very frightening grounds. Then he goes on to say, if we want to talk about God as person, about God as forgiving, about God as redeeming, the grounds are not going to be in ourselves or in our world. They're going to be somewhere else. And then he introduces us to the grounding for Christianity, which is the event of Jesus. I'll describe only very briefly what he does with that. He says that what we have is Jesus' claim. Jesus doesn't prove that there is forgiveness at all, but Jesus does make a claim. And the claim is that if there is going to be forgiveness, cosmic forgiveness, then God must be personal. And if God is personal, the only way there's going to be forgiveness is if he himself takes into himself the hurt that human beings inflict on one another. Because to be forgiving means somebody has to bear the hurt. If people hurt each other, there are only two ways to deal with the hurt. One is to get even, and the other is to take it. The Christian claim is then based on the notion that God has taken the hurt of human sinfulness into himself in the event of Jesus. And we may either then believe or not believe the claim, but we won't be able to do anything with it at all unless we understand what the claim is and what it is really saying to us. In these chapters then, Lewis has sections called The Rival Conception of God, The Shocking Alternative, The Perfect Penitent, that is, the one who makes our penitence possible, our turning around, our getting a new mind, and then the practical conclusion. If this is all true, then one ought to believe it. There are two ways, he says at the end, in which the human machine goes wrong. One is when individuals drift apart from one another or collide with one another and do damage by cheating or bullying or abandoning. The other is when things go wrong inside the individual. The point here he wants to make is it won't do us any good to tinker with the external relationships of people, to build better laws or to create communities in which we can't hurt each other. It will only help us if we are changed from the inside. That's why Christianity talks about conversion, because it wants to make some internal changes. And God makes that kind of conversion possible only at the point at which he gives us an alternative to believe in. And Lewis's claim is, Christianity's claim is, Jesus is that alternative. Well, I've used up a good part of the time. I don't know how many, let me just ask, how many of you have read Mere Christianity? Okay, so you are acquainted then with the general thrust of it. Do you ever feel that you want to argue with Lewis, or that some of what he says and does doesn't make sense to you? Or how do you react to it? Maybe that would be a better thing to ask you. What were your reactions to Mere Christianity when you read it? Anybody?
When I was in my first year of college, I read the Eight Hall Davies in Search of the Myth and Soul, and it kind of shattered me. And about a month later, I read Mere Christianity, and it was a picking back up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Putting some pieces together that sounded so reasonable and so orderly, and at the same time rather passionate in the way he described it. And it just was a book for me to write. Place and time, that was about, I guess, in 66. It was a book for the moment to me.
Do you come back to it again, or do you think that you've, in a sense, left it behind you?
I've come back to it only a couple times. It remains warm in my memory, but I don't, like, reread it.
Mm-hmm.
I reread parts from time to time.
Anybody else like to talk about some experiences they've had with it? Yes, please.
I have a bit of a problem with his argument that the sense of morality is a basis for existence of God, because there are other rationales for that. And probably the strongest is the idea of evolution, that it sort of pays socially to have a moral code so that people can cooperate and fit together better. So that over the argument goes that over the thousands of years, people have evolved this moral code and moral feeling. There were groups that didn't have it, and they didn't succeed because they didn't cooperate as well as the groups that did succeed. So that seems to me a kind of a shaky foundation or shaky grounding.
Mm-hmm.
The grounding of the existence or physical existence of reality seems much more convincing to me than this thing that can be explained from evolution.
Do you think that Lewis addresses that objection at all?
I can't remember. Several years ago I read it.
Well,
I remember not being convinced.
Well, he does take this up, and he says that the curious thing about he does say that that many things that we consider fair or right are things that, of course, are also useful or appropriate. But some of the things that are considered fair or right are not socially useful or even very comfortable, and they may, in fact, be destructive. He would say, for example, he would use as an example of this that that if you are walking alongside Railroad Creek or the Plunge, and someone is being swept away by the undertow, the right thing to do in that moment would be to jump in and try to rescue them, even if it might mean that you yourself would be lost in the process, and that the inappropriate or inadequate thing would be not to make the attempt at all. So that his point is, morality, or the sense of rightness, may well not be what is conducive to our survival or convenient to our progress, but rather some things that may be quite uncomfortable, inconvenient, perhaps even destructive. That may not be a convincing reply, but it isn't that Lewis isn't aware of your counter concern. He's saying that when we appeal to what he calls what ought to be done, we are definitely not appealing to that which belongs to our own convenience or survival.
Right, but maybe at the level of the group, maybe that a group where people have appealed to this higher thing, the group does better, it may be inconvenient for each individual. Same idea as the evolution of altruism in animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good for the individual animal, but it's good for the group, the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would say then, I guess if I were Lewis, if I were trying to think as he would, I would try to reply, the group then, the group that needs this has to be all of humanity, at least. It seems to me to be fairly clear now that unless all of us are able to appeal to something that we can say we ought to do, none of us are probably going to survive very much longer on the planet. So that at least the morality of the group would have to be a human morality. Are we getting any closer to...
Well, it seems to me that the way it would, assuming the evolutionary argument is true, the way it would evolve would be that things that are most like us would have the strongest sort of altruistic feelings and feelings about dealing fairly with. So then, any other human being is pretty similar. But we still have some feelings in the animals.
If that sort of thing were going to evolve, though, would it evolve with a sanctum of grace, which is what we have to be talking about with God? I don't think it would. I think it would evolve as a strict morality to make it work for the whole group. If someone broke a rule or a law, get rid of them, destroy them, not forgive them, that doesn't make good sense for the group.
Yeah, Lou, I should.
I'm not saying I believe that this is the
I understand you.
For the
yeah.
Morality, but I'm just saying it's not a very powerful scientific argument for God. At least it's not very convincing to me.
Okay, we have to be clear once again what Lewis is trying to accomplish. He is not trying to talk about the existence of a personal being. All he is trying to do is to say that we can't have a sense of right or wrong without being in the control of something, let's say, some power, like the mathematical tables, which is, in one sense, outside of us and bigger than we are. He does not use that as a grounds for saying God is personal, or God is Christian, or God is gracious, or any of those things. I suppose it's possible for me to think that there are perhaps other ways of getting at the kind of thing that Lewis is trying to get at. I could have cited Paul Tillich or some other theologians in support of this, but Lewis does make, it seems to me, the right conceptual moves in order to make the case for the intelligibility of Christianity. That was the bell saying first setting. So more tomorrow. I want to take up problem of pain tomorrow, and maybe we can continue this discussion. Thanks for being here.